And we are back with another episode of the Commonwealth Ground Podcast. If you are just joining us for the first time, I'm one of your co-hosts, Victoria Snitzer Churchill. I'm a conservative journalist and commentator, and I'm joined in this show by Miss Jackie Gary. And Jackie, my co-host, is a staffer in the Virginia legislature and a staffer on the campaign side outside of legislative times as well. So thank you guys so much for sticking with us and getting back to it. We haven't had an episode in a couple weeks, so we are going to catch you up on this week, everything that's happened for just about the last month here in Virginia, as the legislative session wrapped up and the governor has been able to take action on dozens, if not hundreds, of bills. We're going to highlight a few that we think were some pretty good, solid bipartisan wins, as well as, at least for me, some wins that I thought were good on the Republican side. And as well, we will wrap up with our favorite segment, our Democrat and Republican of the week, but it'll be, you know, over the past few weeks for this week. So without any further ado, I will get us started with the first bill that I thought was pretty great for the governor to sign. He signed a bill to end the practice of legacy admissions within the Commonwealth for public universities, you know, people that have ties to alumni or donors to Virginia's top colleges. And this makes the Commonwealth the second state to end legacy admissions advantages through family connections. And this was House Bill 48, which Youngkin signed. And Colorado was the first state to end the consideration of legacy admission status. So Virginia is definitely kind of on the forefront of this practice, which I was pretty happy to see. Jackie, do you have any thoughts on that particular bill?
Yeah, it's great to be back with you. I know it's been a while since we talked. I didn't actually know that we're the second is where I want to start. Like, it is so rare just because of the way, like, our legislature moves. It's like meets for 60 days max every year, sometimes even less. And so we're very rarely on the forefront of anything. So it's really cool that we get to be like the second to pass this. And on that note, I think it's just a good bill in general. From a Democratic perspective, I mean, like, these legacy admissions and the practice of doing this is really limiting and really limits opportunity for historically marginalized groups, especially. Like, if you're, you know, if you're a school and you're admitting a huge portion of your student body from legacy admissions, you're like cutting out Black people, poor people, like, all, you know, other people of color, other marginalized groups who don't, because of, you know, systemic racism or just like the inability to build wealth in general, like, all you're doing is re-perpetuating these things, right? And so I think that's a really great thing to do. And I think even if our reasons for are doing it for different, like, it's very bipartisan. Like, I can imagine, like, the Republican justification for this being like, it's not meritocratic, right? Like, if you're letting people in, it's not based on whether or not, like, you're good enough, right? It's not based on whether you earned it. And so, you know, it's one of those nice things where I think, like, our reasons are different maybe for supporting it, but we still got to the same end goal. And I don't see many instances of that happening anymore. So I like seeing this one.
Yeah, definitely not too many. But again, you know, this is why we have this podcast, is to highlight these instances of bipartisanship and something that is, you know, when we talk about the Virginia way of making policy, you know, especially in times like this where we have a split a legislature of one party in both chambers and the governor of another party, seeing them come together on something like this is great. You know, for me, I always thought legacy admissions were definitely an interesting element of the college process. You know, as our listeners will know, like, my family is immigrants. And so, you know, even though my parents did go to college, they didn't go to college in this country. And just so I'm the first person to go to college in my family in America, which is a very different system than it is in many other countries across the world. So, you know, whenever I'd see these things about legacy, I'm like, well, I'm not a legacy anywhere. I wasn't a legacy for actually going to college. I wasn't a legacy for being in a sorority. So it's definitely a part of the college experience, both, again, kind of in the college itself, as well as in social groups, that I think is dying out. And, you know, I'm sure there's some people that are sad to see it go, but you know, again, myself and actually now my sister actually just decided where she's going to college. She's actually going to be here in Virginia, which is super exciting. I won't say exactly where, just kind of for her privacy, but I'm very excited that she'll be joining me in the best state in the nation, as she is 9 years younger than me. Yes, the best Commonwealth. of course, as this podcast is called Commonwealth Ground, but she will be at a public university in Virginia, and she's, you know, an IB, well, hopefully she's going to be graduating with her IB diploma out of high school. So like, she is a completely somebody that went in on merit, and, you know, maybe if 10% of the class had to have been legacy admissions, like, I don't know if she would have had an opportunity to go if those spots had been filled by somebody else, even though GPA wise and grade wise and academic wise, she's going to be studying to be an engineer. So she's kind of up on all those areas. And so, you know, my sister and I are the first two, I guess, generation-wise people in my family to navigate the college system in America, which, like I said, is different. So excited. And like I said, very excited that actually she gets to be part of a class that's, you know, not going to have this this practice attached to it. The first one at a public university in Virginia. So very exciting.
That's awesome. Congrats to your sister.
Yes. I was like knocking down her, well, not really her door, because she lives all the way across the country from me right now, but I was like texting her being like, what'd you end up picking with? And she's coming to Virginia. So very excited about that.
As someone who also moved to Virginia for school, it's a great, choice. And hopefully she'll stay here, because that's awesome. In your reporting on this issue, do you sense that like a lot of other states are going to be following the lead of Colorado and Virginia?
You know, honestly, I didn't dive too much into it other than figuring out that Colorado was the first one. I would love to actually look into it now that things are kind of dying down, maybe seeing if any other states have had legislation that was introduced and maybe not passed, or if any other states are thinking about it. Because like you said, I think it's definitely rare to see Virginia on the cusp of something. Also because like really anything that has any kind of money behind it, Virginia is an expensive state to spend money in. So I think that's one of the reasons, like if we're being completely honest and transparent, I think as you and I both know, both from the media side and the legislative side. So I'm honestly, I guess, kind of surprised that no groups tied to generational wealth wanted to like put hundreds of millions of dollars into beating this, but whatever, it's passed, so, you know, signed into law, so it'll be very exciting to see that happen here.
Yeah. So I guess I'll go next on bills passed. I guess I'll also tie it into a veto, because I feel like the two actions were kind of at odds with each other. And so first, Governor Youngkin signed a bill, the Menstrual Data Privacy Act, which protects menstrual data. You know, like if you use a period tracking app, like the health app for iPod or Flow or whatever, it protects that from being subpoenaed or used in a warrant for arrest. But then also simultaneously vetoed a law that would have protected women and doctors from being extradited to other states for having received or provided abortion services. And so I kind of feel like those two things are at odds with each other, right? Because, okay, so we're saying like, we're going to protect your menstrual data, right? Which I think is good. You know, there's not really, especially since Virginia is the last state where abortion services are protected in the South. So receiving an abortion here is legal. So we're saying, yeah, you can't use this data because there's really no other crime on the books that the state is necessary. So we're going to protect it. But we're not going to protect people who followed the laws of our state from being extradited to other states, even though they didn't perform an illegal action there. Like the justification doesn't really make sense to me there. And like, I don't know how you hold those two ideas at the same time. I'm like, if we're agreeing that this thing isn't a crime here and that data should be protected because there's no crime in which it is useful information, then we shouldn't be sending our doctors, Virginians, to other states for following the law here, even if do you get what I'm saying? It's a weird logical fallacy, and I can't rationalize it.
Yeah, I think I understand where you're coming from, but I think to the kind of conservative or Republican brain, which, you know, obviously I'm supposed to be in this podcast and in these discussions, I think my reasoning for it that I would adopt if I had to kind of put myself in the governor's shoes, I would say, you know, the data privacy stuff, I think Republicans, conservatives, especially in the past 3 or 4 years, are just very wary of any kind of data that they have getting into the wrong hands. I think some of it, like I've written about data privacy, again, kind of from the perspective of a gun owner, quite a bit before, and saying like, I really don't think in this day and age you can have total data privacy because your data is out there whether you like it or not. And so I think some of that is a little bit like outside of reality, a little bit paranoid, these kind of perspectives that people adopt. But I think anything that we can do legislatively to limit that is good. And also, again, this is a debate for another time, but the differences between governments versus companies accessing your data, I think that's a very important distinction to make. Because I think one is, you know, people say like your privacy versus your security in the hands of the government, like what is the trade-off that you're willing to have? However, on the, you know, consumer versus company side, a lot of the times you're opting into a lot of these things and you don't even realize. But I think companies are putting out their resources to basically have your data be as private as they think it should be. And then a lot of the times it's like a hindsight 2020 kind of situation where you realize actually they don't really care. All they care about is making money by selling on your data. But they're at least like creating this aura of privacy. But I think with the government, like you kind of expect that because like you're not necessarily signing all these terms of use things and contracts, that it kind of exists more as like a social contract inherently. And so I think when you put it into law, it solidifies that expectation that a lot of people already have. So that's at least like how I would think about the issue. Now, yeah. On the other hand, I think, you know, you obviously have the idea of states' rights, and that a lot of the times, 10th Amendment, states' rights, you know, each person is subject to their own states' rights. And so I think kind of having people that are doing things that are criminal in other states, but then finding out that they're here in Virginia and letting them be dealt with in other states, like that's why we have kind of the framework that is very different legally in a lot of states. And again, like we see this again with an issue that I cover quite a bit, Second Amendment issues, something that's legal in one state is illegal in another. And it could be as much as, you know, 20 miles down the road, like I talk about a lot here in the greater DC metro area. You know, you can pass through 4 jurisdictions in one day, even in the span of an hour, right? Like if you drive from West Virginia to Maryland into DC, you're driving from West Virginia into Maryland into Virginia into DC, and you can do all that within the span of an hour. And you have to know the gun laws in every single one of those states to make sure you're not breaking any of them, theoretically, because they are all different. So if you adopt that legal framework to a lot of other things, I think, at least in the gun community, like the onus to not break the law is on you. And so if you take that into something like the medical field or a legal field, right, like really any kind of specialized profession, you have to be certified to do it within each individual state. And so I think that's where kind of those patchworks really come in, is that like you have to make sure that you are law abiding within the framework that you are practicing in. And so I think that's maybe kind of why is like, you don't want to be making a decision for another state of an action that's illegal there. So right, but that's at least how I would break it down.
And I see what you're saying, but like, that's not what we're talking about, right? Like, we're not talking about, take your metaphor of like driving through four states as a gun owner with different gun laws. We're not talking about like, say you're driving from West Virginia, you drive through Virginia, break the law in Virginia with the gun, and now Virginia wants to prosecute you, and they go to West Virginia and say, hey, can you send this person because they broke the law, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about a woman from like Alabama or something, right? Mm-hmm. Coming up to Virginia for an abortion where it's legal, and Alabama coming to Virginia and saying, we want to prosecute your doctor for breaking our laws. Right? Like that's what we're talking about. This law would have prevented from happening. And I don't see that as the same thing as the metaphor of what you're talking about. Like, if we can't just be prosecuting other people's citizens for not following the laws of a state they don't live in. It's like me, when I was 19 years old, I went on a school trip to Ireland. And in Ireland at 19 years old, I had beer and wine. And that's like the United States trying to prosecute me for following the law of another country that I was in at the time. Like, that's insane. Like, we would say that's insane if the United States tried to prosecute for me because I didn't break a law. But they're saying you broke our laws. And that's not the way that international law works. And it shouldn't be the way that I think
we interstate utilize. Law, yeah.
Yeah, it's not how we should utilize our state laws, right? Like, I'm all for if you
I think
break the law.
I agree with your metaphor as well. I think then the question is, like, in the eyes of a state like Alabama, who's breaking the law? Is it the patient? Is it the doctor? Is it both? Is it neither?
Just because you're the citizen of a state, like, you can't, our law doesn't work. None of our laws work in the way of, like, if you are the citizen of this particular jurisdiction, you have to abide by that law, regardless of where you are in the world or in the country at the time. It is, you have to follow the law of the actual physical place that you are in. And if we start to allow other states to extradite our law-abiding citizens for following our Virginia laws, to go back to your gun metaphor, what's gonna stop? I'm trying to think of a gun metaphor like a similar thing that could work with guns. I'm like, you know, you purchase a gun legally I don't even know. I need more time to put the thought into this metaphor, but like,
say you can purchase a handgun. So most states, if not all, handgun purchasing is limited to 21, I believe, right? That's like pretty standard.
I think so.
So say some state had it where you could be 18 or 19 and purchase a handgun. Some states, I believe, have limitations on that for like military and things like that.
Right.
But you
and
know,
then
say
New York
just
in and said you broke.
Yeah.
Law.
So say you're like 19 and you buy a handgun in West Virginia and you drive it up to New York. You probably couldn't register it in New York. I mean, obviously New York's handgun laws are convoluted anyways, but like, it would basically be New York trying to prosecute you for buying the handgun at 19
even though it was completely
in West Virginia.
Legal. Yeah, even though it was completely legal in the state that you did it in, right? I think we'd both agree that that's insane, right?
Again, with guns, it's convoluted because a lot of the times, like places like DC, register the actual gun you're carrying. So I'm not sure how well that metaphor works, but
let's just say you're traveling and not moving. So I think the metaphor still works there. And so, you know, I just think that like, if we allow that sort of thing to happen, and let's be clear here, that is something that states that are outlawing abortion are seeking to do. Like, this is not a hypothetical. This is a real thing. Like, I think that there are some people who are like, oh, this is not really happening. This is unnecessary. This is the real thing that I believe I've heard of. I don't want to like disparage any state that's not actually doing this incorrectly, but I feel like I've heard of like Idaho doing this potentially or seeking to do this. Like, this is a real thing that state legislators are looking to do. And so we can't dismiss this as like a wild, like hypothetical that like nobody's doing this, because this is a real thing that is happening post Dobbs. And whether you agree with that decision or not, I would hope that we can agree that like going and prosecuting another state's citizens based on laws that don't exist in that state because they broke the law in another state is really, really outside the bounds and really not what the purpose of the Dobbs decision was, or meaning. I mean, I know that there's obviously a lot of people out there who says that's exactly what the purpose of the Dobbs decision is, but if we're truly talking about repealing Roe as an issue of states' rights, then we cannot allow things like extraditing doctors who are following the laws of their own states to occur. That is a clear violation of states' rights. And so I just find that veto incredibly disappointing. And I hope we can pass it down the line, because I think it's going to be a really scary spot for Virginians to be in if we don't.
Well, it's definitely an interesting thing. You know, you kind of talked about that probably being a predominant messaging bill that, you know, if there is a Democrat governor, you know, probably most likely Abigail Spanberger is going to be the Democrat nominee, as we've both looked at polling, you know, most likely probably at least at this point facing up against Winsome Sears. There's also polling that came out about that race. If you guys are interested in that, I could have it linked in show notes. Of a polling that came out, I believe it was done by Signal, spelled C-Y-G-N-A-L, at least on the Republican side. It was Winsome 44 versus Miara's 16% with 41% undecided, margin of error 4.5%. So pretty widespread there. And it was out of 510 likely voters of the 2025 Virginia GOP governor's primary. So, you know, obviously what we've talked about throughout the course of this podcast is that we have the Democrats controlling both the House of Delegates and the State Senate in the General Assembly, with the governor being a Republican. And so we're kind of testing really how bipartisan Virginia is in dealing with this like non-trifecta situation on either side. And, you know, stuff that the governor is vetoing that were passed by both chambers. If you're a Democrat, you know, you're going to use that to go out and vote for Spanberger, of saying, you know, I love these policies, but if only Youngkin hadn't vetoed them, that all be in place. And then on the Republican side, you know, saying, thank God we have a Republican governor for vetoing this. And this is why we need to have a Republican governor, at least, if not a Republican, you know, trifecta, right? But like, is that going to happen? Probably not. But, you know, having at least at minimum a Republican governor, maybe flipping some seats in the House of Delegates or in the State Senate. So kind of on the opposite side of that, something that I was very happy to see the governor veto was, well, he vetoed about 30 different anti-gun bills. Two specifically that I was tracking included one. So this one, I will be completely honest, it sounds good on face value, but when you actually dive into it, it was a very bad bill. So it's about the idea that anybody that had been, and this is a direct quote from the governor's statement, this is a direct quote from the Virginia Mercury, which includes part of the governor's statement. So the way that the Virginia Mercury laid it out was, he vetoed legislation that would have tightened rules requiring people, quote, and this is a direct quote, credibly accused or convicted of domestic abuse to give up firearms. The proposal would have barred those gun owners from giving the weapons to someone else in the same household or anyone under 21. Youngkin said that he took issue with the arbitrary age prohibition and the potential for disarming individuals And this is a direct quote from the governor, quote, disarming individuals not subject to a court order. And so I think I've talked about this on this podcast before, you know, kind of the whole idea of red flag laws and somebody being improperly red flagged is something that I'm very personally wary of, because I had a very close friend whose ex-boyfriend actually threatened to kind of say that, like, she was a danger to herself and have her disarmed so that he could have potentially done some very nasty things to her. And so that's, at least in my perspective, why I think red flag laws are really bad. So this is would have basically been Virginia's version of a red flag law bill. He vetoed it. I thought that was great. And then the second one was, yes, the school boards and safe storage laws. He recommended changes to a bill that would have required school boards to notify parents about gun risks and safe storage laws. Again, I think calling out guns specifically is quite dangerous, because I think there is a lot of different harms that kids can be exposed to. And I think if we call out firearms specifically, it vilifies them, despite kind of their prominence in the community and in our history and in a lot of different really areas of American life that a lot of conservatives want to conserve. And then I think along with that was also one on safe storage kind of being required. I believe his wording on that, I'm sorry, I don't have that one directly in front of me, but he had some wording in there about actually not having basically like an additional financial burden on the cost of firearms ownership. And again, I think that's really important, because in this day and age when life is so much more expensive, protecting your life should not be subject to any additional cost than what already exists. Getting a gun is already expensive. Getting training, which again, I've always been for, I'm not for mandating it, but I sure as hell hope you have your wits about you to go out and get properly trained, especially if you're not raised around firearms. And so there's already so much, I mean, ammunition, like, I've gone out and said it a number of times, like, I wish I was able to get out on the range more than I do, but the cost of ammunition is a lot. And so really anytime you want to go out and put substantial amount of rounds through your gun, that's an added financial burden to the cost of gun ownership. So there's already a lot of different elements that are involved in that. And so I don't think we should be involving that. And so I was really happy with those vetoes from the governor, because traditionally, when Republicans campaign, your kind of stereotypical Republican campaign platforms are, you know, pro-life, pro-gun, pro-low taxes. So when Youngkin was campaigning, he really did not touch the gun issue at all. You know, I don't think he specifically ever came out on the record about this, but like, it was pretty obvious to those of us that were involved in that, that, you know, he thought he wouldn't be able to pull in a lot of the moderates or the swing voters to be able to win the election. And so really, there was a lot of questions on the minds of gun owners of actually how Republican was Glenn Youngkin going to be, and whether he would kind of uphold really a key issue that was so crucial to his base. And, you know, I think a lot of us were very happily surprised with the actions that he took. And, you know, I was one of the people that wrote pieces, I believe, you know, probably 2 or 3 weeks before the veto came, of being, you know, like, will the governor actually have a backbone on this, or will he let himself be railroaded? Is he more concerned with, you know, not pissing people off? Is he more concerned with just being friendly with the legislature? Because again, you know, he had a lot of other things kind of coming down the pipeline, like the arena deal that we've talked about. So we didn't want this issue to kind of be offered up as a carrot or a sacrificial lamb to satisfy Democrats to kind of accomplish other parts of his agenda. So I think he did well on that. Again, I personally, obviously, as a conservative pro-gun voice on this podcast, good job, Governor, for doing that. I was very happy with that. So that was my soapbox. Jackie, I don't know if I wanted to give you kind of your final soapbox of what we talked about, we wanted to wrap up with on the bill.
Yeah, no, there's two others that I think we wanted to talk about real quick, but just really quickly, I did want to point out, and, you know, I think we've talked about guns and we could have a whole episode on guns itself, but I did want to just say, like, totally take your point about the cost of living and stuff. However, we do have in Virginia in regards for safe storage, we do have a tax credit that provides for people to purchase gun safes. And I believe you can get, there's tons of programs that you can get like free trigger locks. So I would hope that nobody's like letting safe gun storage go to the side based on like financial aspects, because there's plenty of ways to do it for cheap or completely free. And I do think that if you're going to own a gun, being safe and responsible with it is a big deal, which is why we have the tax credit program. And so I hope that if you're going to and are listening to this, take advantage of those things and don't let finances be kind of a deterrent to safe gun storage. So the other two big ones, I think, and we can talk about them kind of simultaneously, even though they had outcomes, because I think they're on a similar page. There were some big drug legislation that was some signed and some vetoed. I don't know. What do you want to start with? Do you want to start with the positive? Fentanyl. I think we both see them as both like, I think we both view these actions in the same way, one positive, one negative. And so do you want to start with our like positive or our negative first? Like,
let's do negative, because I just thought about, you know, talked about something that I thought was positive. So we can end on the positive. Okay. And so we can do like positive, negative, positive.
Okay. So we're starting positive or negative first. Negative first.
Negative, yes.
So Glenn Youngkin Governor Youngkin did decide to veto the legislation that would have established a retail cannabis market. And instead of kind of like summarizing, I do actually have the veto statement in front of me. So I'm going to read that because I think it's very instructive and kind of we both kind of have responses to it. So the proposed legislation of retail marijuana in the Commonwealth endangers Virginians' health and safety. States following this path have seen adverse effects on children's and adolescents' health and safety, increased gang activity and violent crime, significant deterioration in mental health, decreased road safety, and significant costs associated with retail marijuana that far exceed tax revenue. It also does not eliminate the illegal black market sale of cannabis, nor guarantee product safety. Addressing the inconsistencies in enforcement and regulation in Virginia's current laws does not justify expanding access to cannabis following the failed paths of other states and endangering Virginia's health and safety. So there's a lot there. I'm going to start. First, I think we have an instance here of where the governor is equaling correlation and causation in a lot of other states. In terms of like mental health deterioration, increased gang activity and violent crime, decreased road safety, there has been a lot of other things going on in the country in the time period where a lot of these states have legalized things, such as the pandemic. And you're seeing these trends happen all across the country, not just in states that have legalized marijuana. Like, there are tons of places where people are less safe on the roads because of unrelated trauma issues to the pandemic, like people have been taking out road rage incidences on the road. Like, that's not necessarily a cause of marijuana. Whose mental health hasn't taken a hit since the pandemic? Like, whose mental health hasn't deteriorated? I don't know anybody that is like, oh yes, I am doing so much better mentally than I was pre-pandemic times. Like, I don't know that person. If that person exists, I'd love to meet them and find out what reality that they're living in, because I don't think any of us are there, right? And so I think we're seeing a case here where he's relating correlation to causation without actually doing any work there. And I also I'm really disappointed, like, this, there's no citation. Like, where are you getting this idea that instituting a retail market doesn't guarantee product safety? And like, if we have regulations and we only allow people to sell product that means specific regulations, you're going to get safer product, right? Because it's not, you can't sell things that are cut with other things. And so I'm deeply disappointed in this veto, and specifically and the statement and the reasoning itself, because I just think I don't think it actually really addresses the reality of these situations. You know, I'm jumping the gun a little bit here, but the bill that we're going to celebrate has to do with decreasing fentanyl overdoses, which I think is great. But I like think that one of the ways you do that, you can do that is by putting a safe product out onto the market and decreasing the reliance on an illicit market. And so, and I just like, it's very out of touch with where the majority of Virginians want to be. And so I am very disappointed in these options. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'll agree with you probably about 95%. You know, I don't like the lack of citations. It does kind of seem to me like he's pandering to a very select group of people. But again, really, I don't really know whatever that is. Like, is that, I mean, is it tobacco farmers? Like, does the tobacco lobby still have that much power over Virginia?
Because absolutely. Like, but I don't know that it's coming from them.
Yeah, like, and again, to me, I always like to put these two things hand in hand, where a lot of Virginia that has been economically depressed because of the lack of tobacco production, I think can actually experience an economic revival if we were to bring commercial marijuana farming, selling, production of products to the Commonwealth. I think it would be great economically, again, like I said, specifically for economically distressed areas. You know, I think as we know, obviously weed most commonly gets compared to alcohol. So I think we can use that comparison in a couple of different elements. First of all, like road rage, dangerous driving, people still drive drunk, even though alcohol is legal. If alcohol was illegal, people would still drive drunk. So are there people that are being under the influence of marijuana and driving? Probably, but there are also people that are doing the same thing with alcohol, even though it's legal. So I don't think that making marijuana legal would really increase the frequencies of that. You know, I completely agree with you of there's been a lot of things going on that have, you know, made our streets and our roads less safe. And I think a very small, minute portion of that is to do with weed. I also do think that, yes, having a legal market for it would make it a lot safer. I think, again, with like fentanyl, right? Like fentanyl now, it's being laced in other things, which is where a lot of these overdoses come from. Like I have been to events specifically in kind of the law enforcement border patrol space where these moms are like, you know, I said my daughter died of a fentanyl overdose. And you kind of come up with this idea of like somebody that's been an opioid user for a decade, and you kind of have an image of what that looks like. And it's like, no, you have, a lot of the times it's cocaine, it's, you know, any other kind of drugs and weed that get laced with it. And so people don't even know they're taking it. I'd say probably 80% of the time where it's like an overdose. It's literally, you know, the slogan is like one pill can kill. That is exactly what happens in all of these situations. So I think by like, yes, if you create a market, will those occurrences still happen one off? Absolutely. I mean, alcohol is legal. You can sell it. You can buy it. Obviously, you have different regulations in different states. Does that mean people don't make bootleg moonshine in the back of their garage and do stupid things with it? Sure. Does that mean people don't homebrew beer? No, but they're not going off and selling it to a mass market because people aren't going to go to their neighbor and say, get me that bootleg moonshine that you've been brewing for 4 years in the back of their garage, because they can get similar things in other ways, right?
Right.
So I think there's a very clear parallel to be drawn between that. You know, again, kind of in the Republican ecosystem, at least the people that I surround myself with, I think this issue is much more of a generational issue than it is a partisan issue. I think most Republicans my age would be pretty pro-marijuana legislation and legalization. And I mean, you know, right? It's like former Speaker John Boehner is now a marijuana lobbyist. So I think that goes to show that this is really not a partisan issue. And yeah. I think there's a lot more positives to be done with it than negatives. And then, you know, again, this takes me back to a statement that I've made on the show before. Like, I think, getting rid of Delta 8 sales is one of the stupidest things that Youngkin has done as governor. And again, it's like, why? Like, is it because of the tobacco lobby? Because other than that, I have no other reasoning of to why that could have happened. And again, you know, in a free market capitalist system, the government should be picking winners and losers. And so if consumer choice drives us to weed over tobacco or alcohol, then let the consumers and the free market take it away.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm there with pretty much all of that. I have no idea. I mean, the tobacco lobby is pretty powerful. I have no idea if they're involved on this issue or not. My boss does not sit on those committees, so I'm not really getting those meetings. My sense is that it's coming more from like the family foundation type of folks, are the ones really kind of driving, the opposition to this, just from my general knowledge and like what I've seen in the public. No idea what's happening behind the scenes, but I haven't really seen the tobacco lobby take a big stance on, cannabis. It's really been more like the family foundation type folks. So
even going back to somebody like John Boehner, I think he's pretty well known for being like a pretty big cigar aficionado. So like even on that level, right, it's like tobacco and weed don't necessarily need to be diametrically opposed. I think they're often painted as opposites, right, but I think a lot of the time it's their user market is actually not that dissimilar from one another.
Exactly, which, you know, might drive problem. I don't know. I don't know. It's really not my area of expertise on like, you know, that market, but it is, you know, it is disappointing, but you know, we do have one more year of Governor Glenn Youngkin. And so he has time to kind of learn and I think make the right decision, because this issue is not going to go away, right?
Like, no, it's not.
It is not going, especially because we are in such a gray area where it's like decriminalized and it's legal to have, but not like, this is not going to go away. And I think even amongst like the Republican legislators, like, I don't know that they're all totally psyched to like legalize a real smoker, but like I think there's a recognition that there's not the will to recriminalize. And so if we don't have a will to recriminalize, we have to move forward with a retail market. So do we want to enter our positive on our fentanyl overdose?
Yes. So I believe it was earlier this week. I think it was Tuesday. Let's see. I think I wrote about it in my article. I'm just looking at it on the back end here. Thursday. So yeah, it was super recent. So I guess it must have been last Thursday then. It was this Thursday. Okay, I guess it must have been this Thursday. I'm sure with you, all of my days kind of blend together. But at least a sentence that I wrote in this article, whatever Thursday I was referring to. Thursday, he signed into law Senate Bill 469 aimed at combating the fentanyl crisis. It was Senator Mark Obenchain's bill. State Senator John McGuire was a chief co-patron of the legislation, also backed by, obviously, the governor and A.G. Meares. So kind of a lot of big Republican names were for it, but it was also a bipartisan bill. So, you know, I think it's a good win. So it kind of takes big steps to combating the fentanyl crisis. In Meares's statement, he noted that we lose an average of 5 Virginians every day to fentanyl overdoses. The rise of counterfeit drugs and synthetic opioids like fentanyl continue to fuel the drug epidemic gripping the nation right now. But Virginia is fighting back, he says. And again, I believe that the fentanyl use is driving the drug epidemic a lot more than something like marijuana. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, as someone who is pretty pro legalized drug use, I mean, with some restrictions, but like, you know, it is like there are still drugs out there that are causing massive problems in here, contributing to a huge death, and fentanyl is one of those, and it's not something that should be consumed like that. And so I think, you know, legislation that we have to get at the people distributing it, I still pretty strongly believe that even with stuff like that, we should not be criminalizing the people who are using it, but you know, getting at people who are distributing it and having these things to harm others, I think that's that's a good thing. And so I'm glad we have some further action to combat this. Hopefully we'll have, hopefully it would help contribute. I know it's always one of these things that we talk about, like, you know, will this actually get at the reduction?
Yeah, there's not a silver bullet solution because there's so many different ways. And again, you can try to combat it legislatively, but a lot of the times it comes into the enforcement. It comes into a lot of different areas of society that need to change to completely do away with this problem. But I think any steps that we can take to minimize the impact are good and worthy, and, you know, deserve a seat at the table, deserve a signature to make something from a bill into a law.
Absolutely. All right. So before we do our Republicans and favorite Republicans and Democrats of the week, so I think we'll probably just have one more episode going over maybe two or one and a half, going over the legislative session. Monday, when this episode drops, will be the final day for the governor to act on any bills. And so the governor has three options. He can sign something, he can veto something, or he can let it pass without his signature. We don't have a pocket veto. So today, everything will be acted on. And we still have some pretty large things outstanding, including some stuff that we've talked about here before, skills games, my boss's prescription drug affordability board, the education bill that Victoria and I, Sorensen group, worked on with that, right to contraception, and of course the budget. And so our upcoming episodes, we will recap all the actions that happen by later today, and maybe the reconvened session, which is where the General Assembly goes back to Richmond to vote and basically take action on the governor's vetoes or amendments, and that'll be April 17th. And so that's what we got ahead of us. Do you want to kick us off, Victoria, on your favorite Democrat of this week, or I guess of the last month? It's been a while since we've checked in.
Yes. No, but it's okay. I think we got a good episode out of it, so I think that was a good decision. Let's see. So for me, honestly, Luis Lucas. So I had the great fortune of being invited. You know, she might be my favorite Democrat, which is weird because she causes the Republicans a lot of headaches, but, like, I don't know why. I think
she's been your favorite Democrat on this segment, like, three or four times, which is not a bad thing.
John Fetterman, too. He had some other statement the other he had some other statement the other day about, like, how crime is getting really bad, and I'm like, yes, John. Step it up. But anyways, back to Luis. So I had the great fortune, thanks to actually a Sorensen cohort member of both of ours, Eric. He just left his job in the governor's administration, but thanks to him, my husband and I were extended an invitation to attend the governor's Women's History Month reception at the end of last month. So it was a very great opportunity to go to Richmond, visit the executive mansion. Had never done that before, so that was super fun. But that event was very bipartisan. Luis was there as well as a number of prominent Democrats. Don't want to name any just off the top of my head, just in case I mix anybody up. But Luis was definitely there, and I thought it was very good of her and any other Democrats that attended to attend that, to kind of celebrate women and their accomplishments in the Commonwealth and celebrate the legacy of women and kind of steps that the Commonwealth is doing to cement the futures of women and make this a really great place for women to, you know, as the governor always says, live, work, and raise a family. Because at the same time as all of that was going on, so were all of these vetoes. And so kind of having all of this, like, behind the scenes drama versus, like, a public, well, I guess semi-public, semi-private event. So, you know, basically whatever issues the governor and Luis and other legislative leaders were having, that didn't taint the event at all, at least from what I saw. You know, maybe there was some whispering that missed my ears, but at least from what I saw, everybody was very positive, upbeat, had a great time at that event. So I was very happy to see that.
Awesome. And so for my favorite Republican of the week, you know, I think I've been pretty harsh on him this episode, and I think for good reason, but I will give props to Governor Youngkin for signing that mental data privacy bill, especially because I know that it was actually killed last year, partially because he had put some pressure on House Republicans in the last legislative session. But, you know, I wasn't part of that effort. I don't know what conversations he had. I don't know, you know, what he heard, but he heard someone and heard the need from it. And, you know, it, kind of changing your mind in politics is really difficult. And it's really difficult. And there's a lot of incentive to not do that. But he did on this and for something that's really important. And so, you know, all of my prior gripes with him that I like put out earlier still stand, but do give props and kudos for signing that bill.
Yes, give credit where credit is due. And again, you know, even though I'm a Republican, I'm not like worshiping him at his feet. I call him out when I think he does stupid stuff. So, you know, I think even if you call him out a majority of the time, you can still recognize when he does something good, which is again why this space and this show exists. So thank you everybody so much for joining back with us. Again, we're posting Mondays. We kind of took every Monday out of the expectation because we just kind of have crazy schedules. But I think it's still a very fun endeavor, and we plan to keep doing it as long as at least somebody listens every week. So thank you guys so much for tuning in. Jackie, do you have any final thoughts on this week's episode?
Just to say that at the end there, you know, like, you know, if you don't recognize what people do right and just choose to focus on the bad stuff, then they don't do the thing. They'll just stop doing the things you want them to do. So, you know, that's why I will continue to give props to people like Governor Youngkin for the stuff I like, even when I'm mad about him and other stuff. And, you know, I think we need a little more of that in our politics going forward. But yeah, hopefully now that we're back from Richmond, I know that has been getting in my way of being able to be so active, but hopefully now that we're back, we can be a little more regular about our posting schedule. And thanks to everyone who's checking back in and listening and sharing with your friends. Really appreciate hearing from you.
Bye guys, and we'll catch you next time. Signing off, Victoria and Jackie.
Bye.